From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a perspective on the Gulf crisis from Baghdad. Trudy Rubin, Mideast expert with the Philadelphia Inquirer, just spent 11 days there. Also, a historical perspective on today's conflict in the Gulf. David Frumkin explains how the map of the Middle East was redrawn by France and England after World War I. Here in the States, the FBI has been questioning Arab American leaders to help prevent hate crimes against Arab Americans and to enlist the support of Arab Americans against Iraqi terrorism. We hear from the FBI and from the head of an Arab American group that is protesting this FBI investigation. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. On the day before the United Nations deadline in the Persian Gulf, top Syrian officials have made an unannounced trip to Saudi Arabia. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Riyadh. The group's expected to meet with Saudi King Fahd and the prime minister.
Over the past few weeks, the Iraqi army stationed in occupied Kuwait has relaxed the curfew in Kuwait City, according to Suleiman al-Mutawa, Kuwait's planning minister. In the past few days, Iraqi soldiers have been conducting searches for young Kuwaiti men, he says.
And I think they are either looking for them in order to prevent their cooperating with the liberation forces, or to look for weapons and guns that had been hidden in order to avoid their avenging themselves from the retreating Iraqi army.
Suleiman al-Mutawa, Kuwait's planning minister. This is Deborah Amos in Saudi Arabia.
Israeli officials say their air force is prepared for an Iraqi strike. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Army radio today reported that Israeli officials believe it is possible that Iraq may launch a missile attack on Israel even before tomorrow night's midnight deadline. The official said the army is prepared to respond to any Iraqi attack whenever it comes. The Israeli statements came a day after Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger asked Israel not to respond to an Iraqi attack. The administration fears that an Israeli response could make the anti-Iraqi coalition fall apart. But Israeli officials have rejected Eagleburger's request and said Israel will be responsible for its own defense. Meanwhile, the Israeli army continued to distribute gas masks to all Israeli citizens, including those in the Israeli-occupied territories. Palestinians are not scheduled to get the masks. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
In Paris, French Culture Minister Jack Lang said in a television interview today that France will unveil a last-ditch initiative for peace. Lang said France would make its proposal at the United Nations around 5 p.m. Eastern Time. The French news agency Agence France-Presse reports Iraqi President Saddam Hussein said today he was willing to give Saudi Arabia guarantees he would not attack the kingdom. Agence France-Presse says Saddam's statement was carried on Iraq's official INA news agency. Cable news network this afternoon quotes an Iraqi official as saying Iraq is not opposed to the question of removing its troops from Kuwait, but it resents the concept of a deadline to do so. CNN says the official repeated Iraq's call for an international conference to discuss the Gulf and the Arab-Israeli conflict. European Community Chair Jack Pose will meet with Palestinian Liberation Organization head Yasser Arafat tonight. Pose said he hopes Arafat can urge Saddam Hussein to leave Kuwait. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 18.56 points at 2482.92. This is National Public Radio News. Anti-war rallies were held across the United States today. In Minneapolis, demonstrators burned an American flag. In Chicago, a downtown intersection was blocked during rush hour. Police arrested more than 100 people. Protesters disrupted traffic on the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. Officials closed the bridge temporarily, and southbound traffic was backed up for 15 miles. There were several demonstrations in New York City, one in front of a military recruiting office in Times Square. Anti-war rallies were also held in Washington, D.C., Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Montpelier, Vermont. San Francisco's new video display terminal ordinance has attracted a flood of eager salespeople looking to cash in on the law. The ordinance requires businesses to provide adjustable furniture and equipment for employees who use computers frequently. But Tui Vu of member station KQED reports some salespeople may be charlatans.
Ergonomics is the science of designing furniture and equipment to fit the user. Currently, there are no licensing or certification procedures to separate the true ergonomists from fakers looking for a quick buck. And there are few independent resources for employers to consult to learn what works and what doesn't. This has led ergonomics experts at universities and other institutions to fear that employers may end up buying equipment that don't benefit their workers, or even worse, could hurt them. The experts say procedures for the licensing of consultants and guidelines for identifying ergonomically correct furniture and equipment could be years away. David Thompson, a Stanford University professor who sits on the San Francisco Video Display Terminal Advisory Committee, says for now it's still a let-the-buyer-beware economy. For National Public Radio, I'm Thuy Vu in San Francisco.
And this report just in from the Reuters news agency, Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations said Monday French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas will probably go to Baghdad for a last-ditch effort to avert war. Asked about a possible French peace plan, the Iraqi envoy said, "We believe France better than other members." I'm Laura Kanoy in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a world of difference between considering the Gulf crisis from the United States and looking at it from Iraq, according to Trudy Rubin. Rubin left Baghdad for Amman, Jordan, Friday, after spending nearly 2 weeks in Iraq. Rubin is a Mideast expert on the editorial board of the Philadelphia Inquirer. She spoke with us earlier today from Amman and described how things looked from Baghdad.
When you're inside Iraq, you realize how many troubles there are within the country. You also realize that in some ways Saddam Hussein is more popular in other parts of the Arab world than he is at home. When you're inside Baghdad, you're aware of the terrible fear that people have, that they're going to be bombed, that they're being dragged into a war. There's a tremendous unhappiness at the massive conscription, which has gone down to 17 years of age. It's causing enormous hardship. People feel that they have absolutely no power over their lives. They're frightened, and they just don't know what to do. So you see that the society is uneasy, unhappy. They're not able to do anything about it, and they're also going deeper and deeper into the economic hole.
You know, in the United States, President Bush has compared Saddam Hussein with Hitler, not only because he's a brutal dictator, but because of the potential power that he has in the region that he operates in. Do you think that that's a good comparison?
I think that it's an exaggeration. There is no question that this is a bad man. You cannot be in that country and not just be overwhelmed at the cult of personality, at the fear that he has instilled in people. When people talk to you, sometimes they'll whisper to you and make a motion across their throat. And basically what they're telling you is that if it was known they were talking to you, they would literally be killed. This man does not play softball. On the other hand, this is a country of 17 million people that's in deep economic trouble. It's true, it's sitting on huge oil resources, so that gives it a real leg up. But it's not in a position to dominate the world. This is a regional troublemaker. You have to keep in perspective that this is not a man with unlimited resources. And in a sense, I think that by building him up, not only have we created the image of a monster that is greater than the reality, but in addition, I think he has bought into the line that that the United States has been creating. And I think his image of himself has increased to the point where he thinks of himself as a mini superpower.
Well, while you were in Baghdad, did you get a sense of being hated for being American?
No, and I think this is one of the most amazing and really poignant experiences that I and most other Americans who were there as journalists had. One of the funny parts, if I guess it was funny, was that in the beginning, the first few days I was there, when people would hear that I was American, they would think I was a hostage who didn't get out. People were always asking, "Did you miss the plane?" And, of course, then when they would find out you were a journalist, they would get a little nervous. But basically, people were very open to Americans. Enormous numbers of people have relatives in the States, which they were always telling you about. I must have met a dozen people who had planned trips to the States that last summer and had to cancel them because of the August 2nd invasion. I never met somebody who expressed animosity towards Americans. Basically, they would come up when they found out you were American. Somehow they thought maybe you could tell them if there was going to be a war. People were always asking me, is there going to be a war, and asking me what they could do. And it was a very strange and painful feeling to be talking to people who are really innocent pawns caught up in this. and who are asking me, an American, what they could do to avoid American bombs.
If we didn't attack Iraq, but we tried to go with sanctions for a longer time, do you think that they'd be effective?
I came out very dubious about the possibility of sanctions alone changing Saddam Hussein's mind, even though I also came out very disquieted about the likely repercussions of war throughout the area. The problem with sanctions is that the part of the sanctions which most affect ordinary people and therefore have the most potential to create unrest are the part of the sanctions that are working the least well, and that has to do with food and basic supplies of life. The stores are just full of food 5 months after the embargo started. And on those areas where there's any danger that you might get public unrest, for example, gasoline rationing, there was a rumor, it was more than a rumor, that they were going to introduce coupons, and that caused fights at gas stations, and so they immediately rescinded that. But as long as there's no shortage of bread, I was told repeatedly by people there and by diplomats who've been there a long time, and I could sort of see with my own eyes, they just have access. They have had a very good harvest this fall. They put in an extra harvest, which they're hoping for a bumper crop in the spring. There's a lot of foodstuffs that have come in from Kuwait. There just is not the kind of shortages that's going to cause real difficulties for him. And while there's beginning to be shortages of spare parts and small light industry is shutting down, that's a very small sector of the economy. So I think it would be a very long-range process. I think where you do see problems is that he's running out of cash, and so they're revving up the printing presses, and that means that inflation's going to set in. But again, you know, that's a process. I think it would be a long time before you'd see a rebellion. So the problem is that I think sanctions would be a very, very long-range game, and he's willing to let his own people suffer.
Trudy Rubin is on the editorial board of the Philadelphia Inquirer. She spoke to us from Amman, Jordan. Some of the roots of today's conflict in the Gulf can be traced back to 1922. That's when the European nations that were victorious after World War I divided up the fallen Ottoman Empire. They redrew the map of the Middle East, creating new nations and new borders. My guest David Fromkin is the author of a book on the creation of the modern Middle East. He gave it the intentionally ironic title, A Peace to End All Peace. France and England were the two primary powers that reshaped the map of the region. Fromkin says the new nations they created were really artificial state systems.
There had been kings and emperors since time immemorial, but the particular kings who were appointed and put on thrones by the British at that time were not native to the countries that were handed over to them to rule. More to the point, the countries themselves, in many cases, had no historical background and no reality in terms of the sense that the people of that area had that they were a nation.
We say nationalism was an alien concept, the idea of loyalty to a particular country. What was alien about it?
The basis of loyalty in the Middle East at the time and for centuries before then had principally been religion. And to the extent that it was not, the basis of loyalty was family, tribe, clan, sect, call it what you will, the locality in which you lived. Middle Easterners had loyalties that were local, except to the extent that they had religious loyalties. There were not nations or countries in the European sense or the American sense of the word, and they hadn't developed a feel for that at that time.
So when you had people of different tribes or different religions now sharing the same country, there were feuds between them, and I guess we're seeing the repercussions of that now.
Yes.
What were the European claims to the Middle East in the teens and the early 1920s? What gave them the authority to redraw the map?
It came about, really, because they won the war. But I think you have to go much, much, much further back, hundreds of years back, to when the Europeans started to explore the globe, Columbus, Vasco da Gama, back to the era of the explorers. And starting at that time, the Europeans conquered or settled every part of the rest of the world. And the Middle East was one of the few areas left, almost the only area left, as of, say, 1914, that the Europeans had not taken in hand, reorganized and made in their own political image. The Europeans felt, had felt for a long time, that someday they would have to take the Middle East in hand, that it was not capable of governing itself. And the moment came when the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire that then ruled the Arab Middle East, recklessly and unnecessarily entered the First World War on Germany's side. And when they did that and then lost the war, that meant that Britain and France were in possession of the Middle East and in a position to determine its future.
Would you give us a quick review of which country drew and controlled which Middle East state?
Syria and what is now Lebanon were controlled by France, who drew their boundaries. And Britain was in occupation of, in control of, what is now Egypt, Israel, West Bank, Jordan, and Iraq, with protectorships over Kuwait and the other Gulf sheikdoms.
Now, how did it end up being Britain and France that took control over these states?
In the First World War, Britain was the Allied power that was most concerned in the fighting in the Middle East. It was Britain that defeated the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire. And at the end of the war in 1918, there was a million-man British army in occupation of the Middle East, and it was the only coherent military force in the entire region. That meant that Britain was in effective control of the entire Middle East.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Frumkin, and he's written a new book called A Peace to End All Peace. It's about the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the creation of the modern Middle East. When Britain and France divided up the territory and redrew new boundaries, you've told us that these boundaries didn't reflect tribal loyalties or religious loyalties. What did they reflect? How was the map redrawn? How were the boundaries decided on?
Those boundaries, in large part, reflected the administrative convenience of the occupying powers or the political realities of the situation between them.
What did the European countries want from the Middle East? Why did they want the territory?
For different reasons. Both Britain and France wanted control. They were imperialist powers that simply liked controlling a lot of things. British Prime Minister David Lloyd George felt that Britain ought to gain territory and control in the Middle East to compensate Britain for all the losses suffered during the war. Traditionally, Britain had also wanted control of that area, or at any rate wanted to exclude any enemies from control of that area in order to protect Britain's imperial road to India. The French, who were in the Middle East at the same time, in addition to feeling a sense of rivalry with England, had strong commercial and even stronger religious interests in the area as protectors of the Maronite or essentially Roman Catholic population in the canton of Lebanon. So it was a great mix of reasons. Very late in the day, both powers discovered the importance of oil. And it was suspected that oil existed in the Middle East. They didn't know that it existed in the great quantity that we now know that it does, but that was yet one more reason for their being interested in the area. Finally, in Great Britain, there was a strong sentimental interest based on studying the Bible when everyone was children, a very strong sentimental interest in seeing to the fostering of a Jewish state, a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
Now, you say that by the time the lines of the map were redrawn and became official in 1922, Europe no longer believed in them.
It was Britain. Britain that had drawn the most lines, had been most responsible for the settlement, didn't. Britain had been changing during the war and after the war. One of the most important events that took place in the first instance had nothing to do with the Middle East. That was the very great economic collapse, the economic downturn in Britain after the war, which made the British voter feel that he didn't have the money or the resources to embark on foreign and imperial adventures, that the money and resources were needed at home to build industry and create jobs. And so for that reason, Britain turned away from the from the idea of foreign adventures and such. Moreover, there had been a lot of unrest in the Middle East after, and a lot of disorder after the First World War. It was evident that it was becoming evident that it would really take a lot of commitment of resources by Britain to maintain a position there, and the whole thing just started to look much less attractive than it had before. So that there were many in England, not everybody, but there were many in England, certainly in the electorate, in the Parliament, in the press, that turned against the arrangements that Britain had made.
Where does the United States fit in to the creation of the modern Middle East?
The United States, too, changed its mind. Under President Woodrow Wilson, who was in office until early 1921, the United States had an idealistic program of trying to ascertain the wishes of the inhabitants of the Middle East as to what form of government they should have. As far as rhetoric was concerned, President Wilson was opposed to the extension of French and British imperialism to the Middle East. America was against imperialism. But Wilson was not effective in his opposition to Britain's plans and France's plans. Once he left office and President Harding took office, America's policy changed dramatically. We were then interested exclusively in the exploitation of oil in the Middle East. That was really our concern, our only concern. And we felt that the exploitation of oil would be facilitated by the creation of stable regimes. And in turn, our idea of a stable regime was the sort of regime that Britain would establish and administer. So we were all in favor of British rule in the Middle East, at least as much as the British were, maybe even more than the British were, under President Harding.
We're talking about a subject that's crucial to understanding what's happening now in the Gulf, and the subject is how the modern Middle East was created, how the map was redrawn after World War I and the fall of the Ottoman Empire. My guest is David Fromkin, the author of the book A Peace to End All Peace. He's an international lawyer and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Fromkin is my guest, author of the new book, A Peace to End All Peace, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Creation of the Modern Middle East. Let's look specifically at Iraq now. Iraq was created as a British protectorate in 1922. How was it formed?
It was formed from three provinces, Basra, Baghdad, and Mosul, that were then in the possession of Great Britain, British India. Britain put the three together and made a country out of them, and nominated a monarch to be their king, and set them up as a country.
No, it was England that established the boundary between Saudi Arabia and Iraq, yes?
Yes, and Kuwait.
And Kuwait. Three countries in the middle of what's happening at the Gulf now. Do the conflicts between Saudi Arabia and Iraq and between Iraq and Kuwait relate at all to how England drew their boundaries in 1922?
That's a kind of red herring that Saddam Hussein introduced. The drawing of that line in 1922 should not have affected politics today. At the time, the problem for England was that she had put Faisal, an Arabian prince, on the throne of Iraq. But the great enemy, the great blood enemy in Arabian politics of Faisal's family was Ibn Saud, who created what we now know as Saudi Arabia. Ibn Saud led warrior bands that were fierce and victorious. They were defeating the forces of Faisal's family everywhere in the Arab world. And Ibn Saud's forces threatened to go into Iraq, into what is now Iraq, and Ibn Saud had vast territorial claims on what is now Iraq. So to protect their protege, Faisal, and at the same time satisfy Ibn Saud, who also was a British-supported leader, the British High Commissioner in Baghdad drew a frontier line between Iraq and Saudi Arabia that was favorable to Iraq and compensated Saudi Arabia, in turn, by giving Saudi Arabia two-thirds of the territory that then belonged to the city-state of Kuwait. So the loser in that settlement was Kuwait. The beneficiary was Iraq at Kuwait's expense. So it is ironic indeed that Saddam Hussein, citing the unfairness of that frontier, should have invaded Kuwait. It was really Kuwait that could have claimed that the frontier line was unfair to it.
So Iraq really has no claim, you think, to any territories in Kuwait?
None at all. No valid claim based on history, none.
Now, you said that when Iraq was created, it was a country, but it wasn't a nation. What do you mean by that distinction?
In the north of Iraq, in the province of Mosul, was a largely Kurdish population, quite distinct from the Arab inhabitants of the country, very different, with a sense of their own peoplehood, if you will. The city of Baghdad, the capital, was predominantly Jewish at the time. It was one of the two great Jewish cities of Asia, along with Jerusalem. And as far as the Arab populations of the Baghdad province and the province of Basra were concerned, they were split between Shiites and Sunnis, who did not recognize one another as being part of the same group.
So suddenly all these groups were part of one nation and had a lot of conflicts with each other.
Yes.
Do you think that there are still many people in the Arab world that have no respect for the state borders that were drawn?
Yes, I do. On the other hand, in the course of time, there are those who have sort of grown into these boundaries and into these states, artificial though they were decades ago. After all, it's nearly 70 years since those boundaries were drawn. And one of the things that I've warned against in my book is that once you start regarding one or more of these boundaries as artificial and therefore invalid, and knock it out because it's invalid, you invalidate everything. The whole region is in chaos. And it might be far better, whatever the merits of the current state system and the current frontiers, it really would in many ways be far better to accept them as they are and try to live with them, which is what the states in Africa have done, which were equally artificial. But in Africa, the Organization of African States has had the statesmanship and the good sense to say, we have to start from this departure point. All frontiers are inviolate. Let's live with them. And I think that's the way the Middle East has got to go, too, if it ever wants to achieve peace.
My guest has been David Fromkin, author of the book A Peace to End All Peace, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Creation of the Modern Middle East. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During World War II, thousands of innocent, loyal Japanese Americans were interrogated and interred by the American government. That bit of history is behind the concern of many Arab Americans today, in the wake of a new FBI policy of questioning prominent Arab American leaders. Coming up, we look at both sides of the issue with Albert Mokaiber of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and with Bill Baker, the assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigation Division. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff examines one example of how Hollywood is depicting Islam. He reviews the film Not Without My Daughter, starring Sally Field. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. France will unveil a last-ditch peace initiative within the hour at the United Nations. Meanwhile, Iraq's ambassador to the UN says French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas will probably go to Baghdad for talks with President Saddam Hussein. Asked why the French, the Iraqi ambassador said France was more familiar, understanding, and sympathetic with countries in the Persian Gulf region. A group of retired military officers who oppose the use of force in the Gulf charges the Bush administration is encouraging exaggerated expectations for a quick and relatively painless war against Iraq. NPR's Caroline Clark reports.
The Center for Defense Information projects that if the U.S. winds up fighting in Iraq as well as Kuwait, the result could be at least 10,000 U.S. fatalities and 35,000 U.S. injuries. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Piers Wood believes that public support for combat in the Gulf will drop if casualties do approach these numbers.
The public's widely reported support for the upcoming war with Iraq is entirely contingent on the expectation of a quick, decisive victory and a low casualty rate.
Rather than a quick strike over in a few weeks, the center projects the war will stretch on for months as the U.S. battles the weather, the terrain, and Iraqi dedication to protecting their homeland. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
The prime minister of Yemen is in Baghdad with a six-point peace plan. Yemen says the U.S. backs the proposals, but the plan includes a direct link between an Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait and an international peace conference on Palestinian issues, an idea the Bush administration has repeatedly rejected. Amnesty International says Soviet officials must investigate Sunday's violent clashes in Lithuania. 13 unarmed demonstrators were killed in the fighting. Meanwhile, the European community is threatening to cut off aid to Moscow. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from London.
EC foreign ministers issued a warning that they will suspend more than $1 billion in financial assistance to the Soviet Union if there is any repeat of the weekend's violence in Lithuania. The 12 ministers called on Moscow to pull its troops from Lithuania and restore the situation to what it was before the crackdown. British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd, who wanted a stronger response to the crackdown, said nonetheless that the EC was sending a clear message.
I think we all thought it was very important that the hardliners in the Soviet Union shouldn't believe that they can get away with whatever they like in the Baltic republics because we're all worried about the situation in the Gulf.
NATO ambassadors also condemned the crackdown and said that further action would damage East-West relations. This is Brian Naylor in London.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 17.5 points to 2483.91. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-1. This is National Public Radio News. Iraq's ambassador to the U.S., Mohammed al-Mashat, has decided to leave Washington before the United Nations deadline for his country's troops to withdraw from Kuwait. According to Reuters News Service, four other lower-level Iraqi diplomats will remain at the embassy. Florida's citrus industry is expecting bumper crops in the near future, but as Dave Pignanelli reports, that's not good news for growers.
Florida's orange juice market is about to be flooded. The state is producing one of its biggest crops in a decade. That should be good news, especially since California's citrus crops are experiencing freeze damage from an unexpected cold snap. But Florida industry officials say the glut of orange juice will make it harder to sell their products at a reasonable profit. According to officials, bumper crops are forecast for the next several years, translating into smaller profits for the grower, processor, and the marketplace. To make matters worse, Brazil, the world's leading producer of orange orange juice reports record crops as well. Industry officials may seek higher tariffs on imported citrus juice in the near future to protect a large domestic market. The winner in all of this will be the consumer, who should begin seeing lower prices at the market later this summer. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The Supreme Court today let stand restrictions on anti-abortion demonstrators in Ohio. The Dayton Women's Health Clinic complained 2 years ago that anti-abortion protesters were harassing staff and patients. Today's Supreme Court ruling upholds an Ohio judge's order to limit picketing to groups of no more than 10, and that demonstrators must stay on the public sidewalk in front of the clinic. The High Court also ruled in a gun control case. Justices said there's no constitutional right to own a machine gun. Ethiopian government troops have killed 46 rebel soldiers today and smashed a rebel bunker. According to the country's official radio broadcast, the government also destroyed rebel weapons and took food supplies. North Korea says both the Soviet Union and the United States should pull their troops from Asia. That statement came from the foreign ministry today. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. There are approximately 3 million Arab American citizens in the United States. In the past week, several dozen Arab American business and community leaders have been questioned by the FBI. The FBI says there are two reasons behind these interviews. The FBI is trying to protect Arab Americans against hate crimes. And the FBI is looking for information that could prevent acts of Iraqi terrorism against the United States. My guest, Albert McIver, is president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. He considers the FBI questioning of Arab American leaders an act of discrimination. This morning, McIver met with the FBI. Later in the show, we'll talk with the assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigative Division, William Baker, who was present at that meeting. I asked Albert McIver what concerns he raised with the FBI.
First of all, we restated our position that we're firmly in support of protecting the American borders and people from terrorism, because we are part of those people and part of that nation. But on the other hand, we're equally opposed to the specific targeting or singling out of Arab Americans for interviews based on what we think is a very fallacious assumption that Arab Americans have some sort of innate knowledge about terrorism. Most Arab Americans, in fact, the overwhelming majority of them, probably have never come close to these issues other than in newspapers and televisions, like all other Americans, and that we felt that based on a faulty conclusion, they've reached a equally faulty or faulty premise, they've reached an equally faulty conclusion, and that they need to suspend these interviews and apologize to the community, and that there are better ways of gathering that information. And the Arab Americans, like all Americans, of course, would come forward if they had any information about any acts of violence or terrorism that were to take place in this country.
What was resolved at the meeting?
Well, we discussed both sides of the issue quite thoroughly and came up with a conclusion that we would meet tomorrow and hopefully come to some sort of understanding where they would modify their program. There's two parts of the program. One we don't object to. One is the investigation of hate crimes against Arab Americans. In fact, we had asked the FBI for assistance in that because during the height of the crisis, when we deployed our troops, there was a rash of anti-Arab violence and discrimination across the country. And of course, the FBI does have proper jurisdiction to investigate those crimes. So we have no problem with the first aspect. The second part, though, that said, while conducting such interviews, we will ask about acts of terrorism, and as we later found out, they were also asking about people's political views. Well, that's totally outside the purview of the FBI, and I think the upper echelon of the FBI today agreed with us that if that type of questioning is going on, that it's wrong. Where we're not in agreement is how they should conduct the interviews regarding terrorism. I think we still have some work in sensitizing them as to the concerns Arab Americans have about being singled out, because we become a suspect class. What happens is, even though the FBI may or may not intend it, there's a backlash result from this type of investigation as well, because as people find out someone's being investigated or spoken to by the FBI, they assume that there's something wrong. So it heightens suspicion, and it takes very little, especially in a very tense situation that we're passing through now, for hate mongers among us to be triggered. And our concern is that, of course, for the safety of the entire nation and of particular concern for our community, given the past history of hate crimes this summer.
Do you know where the FBI got the list of names, the names that they've been contacting?
We asked them that, and what their response was that there is no master list, which put us a little bit at ease, but that they had instructed their field officers to seek out business and community leaders. Now, that's a little vague. There was no definition put on that. And as a result, I would guess it was left to the discretion of field officers as to who was prominent in the community. Now, that may be who was outspoken on a political issue, who has been in the newspaper. And that is a little loose also. So we want them to know that that type of shotgun approach doesn't necessarily help them or us.
What types of questions has the FBI been asking?
Well, in some cases, they've been quite innocuous. Some officers have said, we're here to interview about any potential backlash or hate crimes that have been directed against you or your community. Do you know of any such? And we have no problem with that question. It's something that is fully understandable and to the benefit of the community. However, when those questions break down and then in a very calm manner, very tense questions are asked, such as, well, what are your political views on the Gulf crisis? And what do you believe about our position, or what do you think about X, Y, or Z? Those are political questions. Those are totally irrelevant for the FBI, and those are the questions that violate rather than protect civil rights of Arab Americans. In addition, and I think the most outrageous sets of questions other than the political ones are, well, do you know of anybody who's a terrorist or who's going to blow up a federal building? Well, of course, it's an absurd question. If somebody had that information, for God's sake, they would bring it to the authorities. And if they were part of some nefarious action, they would probably deny it.
Were you one of the people who were called by the FBI?
I was informed that I was about to be called, but for some reason they didn't, perhaps because our phones were so busy with other people complaining they didn't get through, but apparently I was on their list.
Now, the FBI, which you fear might be invading the rights of Arab Americans, is the same group that's responsible for protecting Arab Americans against hate crimes. That must put you in a funny situation because you're protesting the same group who you're also asking to protect you.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I've said on more than one occasion that we feel we have a schizophrenic relationship with the FBI. I was assured today by the director himself that despite our differences that they would not abandon their protection of our community, but of course this is something that's in the minds of all Arab Americans, and it's a very uncomfortable feeling.
How would you rate the FBI in how it's responded to hate crimes against Arab Americans in the past?
With respect to the hate crimes, they've done a fairly decent job, and we have no problem there. Unfortunately, however, the major case in our community, the act of terrorism that was brought against our office in Santa Ana, California in 1985, remains unresolved. At that time, our regional director, Alex Odeh, was murdered when a bomb was placed on the door to our office. This is despite the fact that the suspects in that case are believed to be living under Israeli protection in a West Bank settlement. Now, this may be more of a problem for the State Department to solve, but I would think that all agencies would put appropriate pressure to bring this case to a close, and it makes our community less than comfortable with the efficiency and perhaps sincerity of the government overall when it comes to Arab Americans. But on the other hate crimes, there has been due diligence, and the FBI, we cannot fault them on it, but we certainly can fault them on political surveillance.
Last week, the Justice Department announced that it would start fingerprinting and photographing anyone entering the United States with an Iraqi or Kuwaiti passport. Does that seem legitimate to you?
Well, it's closer to the normal purview of the FBI's duties in safeguarding the borders. Our concern, however, is that this could be the unraveling of rights leading to other issues which the Japanese Americans have kept us fully aware of in their experience in World War II. Once you take an entire group of people, in this case the entire set of Kuwaiti nationals or set of Iraqi nationals, and think that they're a suspect by virtue of the nationality, it causes everyone to be a little uneasy, especially for the Kuwaitis, who in fact are the people the government is fighting for. So it would not seem to make too much sense to take a broad brush and paint everybody into one corner or with one color. So we are very mindful of the need to protect the borders, but at the same time, we have to balance the needs and the protections of person's civil and constitutional rights as they enter this country.
What are your fears for the Arab American community if there is a war?
Our fears is that our neighbors, not the American society itself, it's not an indictment against our friends and neighbors, it's an indictment against racists and hate mongers who exist in every society in every country of the world, and that they would be prompted once again through ultranationalism or a false sense of patriotism to attack Arab Americans, not realizing that Arab Americans are serving in equal proportion in the U.S. Armed Forces right now in the Gulf. Each and every one of us has a friend or a relative who is probably serving the government.
Albert McIver, thank you very much for
your time. Thank you very much.
Albert McIver is the president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. We talk with the FBI after the short break. This is Fresh Air. William Baker is the assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigative Division. He was at the meeting this morning with the head of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. I asked Baker if he thought the committee's complaints were legitimate.
No, I don't. We're trying to get to the entire country to ratchet up awareness as we get into this very crucial time frame. And this is only one element of reaching out to Arab Americans. We're reaching out to law enforcement. We're reaching out to people who run our public utilities, our agents in charge. I've briefed Congress and the Senate. Anywhere where we can reach out to become more aware of the possible threats of a terrorist attack.
Earlier today, you met with members of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. The committee expressed its grievances to you about the way this FBI investigation has been proceeding. There's another meeting scheduled for tomorrow. Do you expect to change your plan at all based on what you heard today from that meeting?
Well, I listened to these two leaders who came to see me, and I think mostly through not having full contact with us earlier on, perhaps, that these gentlemen had concerns about the motive intent or intent of the interviews. The interviews are not political in any way. No instructions were given by us to ask political questions.
The head of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee told us earlier that there had been FBI questions about political beliefs.
Well, I caused to be looked into several allegations that were made, and any specifics we will look into, because as you can imagine, these interviews are being conducted across the country. They're not that great in number. There weren't that many of them scheduled to begin with, so that if we have specific allegations, then I need to know who it was that was interviewed and what it was that was said that was offensive, because our instructions were to pick mature agents, to explain to them the sensitivity of these interviews if they became misconstrued, and to conduct them thoroughly in a voluntary manner and in a non-confrontational manner, because these are leaders. These are not targets. These are not subjects who we're talking to.
The FBI is in a kind of unusual situation here in that the FBI is the group that protects against hate crimes. So this is the group that protects Arab Americans against hate crimes directed at them. At the same time, you're hoping to find from Arab Americans information about terrorism, and that's leading to a kind of different set of questions. I know many people in the Arab American community feel that they're in an awkward position with the FBI because they're feeling violated by some of the FBI's questions. At the same time, they're depending on the FBI for protection against hate crimes. Do you feel the FBI is in a funny position, serving two purposes at one time?
Well, the FBI is often called on to serve several purposes at one time, and we can best do our job when we can clarify the reasons why. I mean, we work very closely with local and state police. Yet we also investigate when they violate civil rights by acting under the color of the law and committing crimes under their uniform. So we're often called upon to perform a dual mission. In this case, though, these were just two messages delivered to leaders. One, the FBI is available and will actively investigate any crimes committed against you based on civil rights violations. And two, and yes, this is a different and totally separate reason, should you come into possession of information, or should people you know and affiliate with come into possession of information about acts of terrorism, we would want that called to us right away. That's the same message I would give to all of America, but we're singling out these people because they do understand the Mideast culture.
I think Arab Americans interpret that as meaning that they do understand terrorism, that you're implying they understand terrorism.
No, we don't imply that. But if their neighborhoods might be used by any individuals, they would best know who's not fitting in. They would best be aware, or they or their affiliates, as to some unusual circumstance. And all we're asking is that they report that to us. And again, the purpose of this, and it shouldn't be misconstrued, is to set up a rapport and a contact with the leaders. Surprisingly, you should know that until a lot of the information about this was made public, my agents in charge advised that the interviewees on the great part were cordial and receptive to these contacts. So we're having a little bit of a difference of opinion, and that's why I do want to meet to Mr. McIver again tomorrow and to discuss with him the responsibility the FBI has, and to listen to him and receive his suggestions on how we could do our job better.
What else is the FBI doing to stop terrorism?
Well, we're doing quite a bit, and unfortunately I can't get into the details of it, but we are concerned that should there be conflict, there might be attempts. This is not a hospitable country for international terrorism. We have reduced the acts of terrorism in this country down to only five last year. And we thoroughly investigate it. We thoroughly prosecute it. And it is not a safe haven for terrorists. So I want to get that message across wherever I can. That's one of the best deterrents, the fact that we've been so successful.
Bill Baker, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Baker is the assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigative Division. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the prospects for peace as we approach the deadline for war?
Well, we have reports coming up about last-minute diplomatic efforts, but frankly nothing very, very promising in the way of an agreement that might avert war. Reports on today's program about scenarios of how fighting might actually begin in and around Kuwait. We'll also hear about the events in Vilnius in Lithuania over the weekend, talk with Ann Cooper, who's there, and also we'll hear the explanation of a spokesman for Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev about what was going on. And a report about the Kurds of Turkey, the minority group that lives in Turkey, Iraq, and several other Middle Eastern countries, and who have a pretty rough ride there.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In light of current events in the Persian Gulf, film critic Stephen Schiff says the new film, Not Without My Daughter, has a loaded message.
The most interesting thing about Not Without My Daughter is its timing. The first film released in any new year is almost always one of the worst. I don't know why Hollywood so rigorously adheres to that law, but it does. And Not Without My Daughter, the first major studio release of 1991, certainly qualifies. But there's something else, too. This is the story, based on fact, of Betty Mahmoudi, an American woman living in Michigan in 1984 with her Iranian-born husband, who's a doctor, and their four-year-old daughter. The husband, played by Alfred Molina, seems like a nice American guy. He's been living in the States for 20 years, but he's getting homesick. Couldn't they just fly to Tehran for 2 weeks to visit his family, let them meet their little girl? Betty, played by Sally Field, is reluctant, but she finally caves in, and off they go. At the Tehran airport, Betty is greeted by wailing women in chadors, and one of the evil-looking crones in her husband's family even foists one on her. Soon she's skulking through Iran's mean streets, covered head to toe, with her little face peeking out, which is meant to be chilling, except it kept reminding me of the flying nun. Well, okay, so Tehran under the Ayatollah is no picnic. Time to go home, right? Wrong. Betty's husband, named Moody, has decided they're never going back to America. A decision Betty naturally can't abide.
I won't live here. I won't bring up my daughter here. How can you even consider raising Mahtab here? Don't you see how they treat women?
I know it's the right decision if you just give it a chance.
No.
For all of us, for you and for Mahtab.
No, Moody, you can't.
I'm a highly qualified doctor. They're desperate for doctors in Iran. I could do a lot of good here.
Please.
Besides,
please.
I'm a Muslim.
Please.
This is where I should be. This
please,
is where my family
don't
should
do
be.
This.
Look. I know it seems harsh, but it's the best thing for all of us. Mahtab could learn real values here.
No, I won't stay here. You can't keep me.
Now, you listen to me. You're in my country now.
The director is Brian Gilbert, whose most significant previous work was a movie in which Judge Reinhold from Beverly Hills Cop switched bodies with Little Fred Savage of the Wonder Years. He directs Not Without My Daughter like the bad TV movie it is, with perfunctory, sloppily staged scenes, lots of shots of evil Arabs sneering into the camera, and lots of hysterical acting. Sally Field's tiny bulb continues to dim as she whines and snivels her way through this one, but what's sadder still is seeing the fine British actor Alfred Molina, whom some might remember from Prick Up Your Ears, struggling with an impossible role. His character Moody suddenly and inexplicably turns from loving hubby into the creature from the Islamic Lagoon. He locks up his wife and daughter, screams at them, won't let them out of the house or near a phone. It's as if the movie were saying to us, she thought he was wonderful, but inside there was something monstrous, unstoppable, the Iranian within. Not Without My Daughter makes occasional limp attempts to leaven its message, but the message remains unmistakable. Muslims are primitive, scary, unyielding creatures. Let one in your life and you're doomed. Which brings us back to the question of timing. Hey, great idea releasing this jingoistic blather January 11th, but that was last Friday. I mean, why play around? Why didn't they just open the thing on January 15th?
Film critic Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Pat Ford, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Sherrock. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a military analysis of the U.S. and Iraq from Admiral Eugene LaRocque of the Center for Defense Information. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.